Dr. Bob and the 12 Men, this is titled Pioneers of AA, Dr. Bob and the 12 men and women who here tell their stories are among the only members of AA's first groups. 12 of these have now passed away of natural causes, having maintained complete sobriety. The periods of sobriety attained by these 13 AAs range from 15 to 43 years as of January 1981. Today, hundreds of additional AA members can be found who have had no relapse for more than 30 years. All of these, then, are the pioneers of AA. They bear witness that release from alcoholism can really be permanent. I give you Paul.
Thank you, Paul. Good evening. You hear me back there? Before I get into my dog and pony show, I'd like to tell you how happy I am to be back again, and I'm quite flattered when I was called and Tom asked me to come up and participate in this program. The last time I was here was at the Cornhuskers, and I'll tell you, I left that conference with a great deal of enthusiasm, and I look back at the experience as being one of the highlights of my AA career. And to be back here and see you again is indeed a treat, and I want to thank you very much. My name is Paul Keebler, and I'm an alcoholic. This is my 45th year in this beautiful fellowship. Now, it pleases me that you're impressed. I'm impressed. But my wife wasn't impressed. And the reason she wasn't, because she was in her 47th year. Never marry a woman that's been in longer than you have, I can tell you that. I don't wish to inject a morbid or a personal note here, but I feel that I must tell you that this lovely lady, some 4 months ago, passed away. For 8 years, she was immobile and not ambulatory. And one of the things that she insisted I do is go to the meetings in spite of the fact she needed constant care. And always I was to bring back the tapes, and then we would have another conference. We'd bring in the pigeons, and it was a lot of fun. And for a number of years, she met and knew a lot of you people intimately through these tapes. And at the Cornhuskers, Dick was gracious enough to give me all of the tapes for that conference, and we played them over and over, and I'm sure that this was a step in the right direction as far as participating in the meeting in absentia, perhaps, but she was there in spirit. So for 8 years, this lady lived in about a 10-foot circle with her books and her typewriter and her equipment and the telephones, and she did a lot of third, fourth, and fifth step work. And it was a beautiful thing to watch this lady. It was just beyond belief to see the patience and the tolerance and the love that she could share with these people. And the last 3 years, we battled the big C, moment by moment and day by day, and we lost the battle day by day and moment by moment. And the father of us all said, "That's enough." And he took her home. And I believe deep in my heart that she is with him and that she's here in spirit with us tonight. And I just wanted you to know that you people played a part in her beautiful expressions that came out of this AA fellowship. So with that in back of me, let me tell you who I am. I'll introduce you to Paul Keebler, the alcoholic. Now, the people in my group refer to me as a bald-headed bleeding deacon with the sex appeal of a wet noodle. They often remark about my fundamentalism. They think I'm to the right of Jerry Farwell and Attila the Hun. Recently I heard it whispered, never ask Heber the damn time of day, he'll make you a clock. But in spite of all those things, so be it. I, of course, like all the rest of you, am here because of the tolerance and the love and the understanding that was given to me. And tonight, since this is the theme of this meeting and of this group is for old-timers, I would like, if I possibly could, at least in your mind's eye, to transport you back this evening to Cleveland or Akron, as it would have been 45, 47 years ago, and see if I can't put you in that frame of reference as we practiced this program and as it was brought into being in those days. And so to do this, I would suggest to you that in back of me, there wouldn't be the traditions, of course, and the steps, but there would be a great placard. And this placard would say, "But for the grace of God." And in the front would be four other placards: honesty, unselfishness, purity, and love. The absolutes, the spiritual concepts of which, by which we recovered for the first time perhaps in history, spiritual concepts were addressed this awful disease of alcoholism. I think if I would also say that I believe that I could put in back of me Bob Smith. There's times when I feel his presence. In all deference to Bill Wilson and those people that went into the East, I came out of the Akron-Cleveland area, so I have to talk from where I came. And I feel Bob's presence and his overview and the spiritual concepts as he taught us and as his early people gave it to us. And I think on my left, I would perhaps like to put my sponsor, Paul Stanley, who was one of the early people in the program. And on my right, my dear friend and wife. And I think if you allow me to imagine or put myself into that aura, I'd like to share with you some of the things that I think are the benchmarks, not only in my recovery, but in the recovery of some of the other people. Now, there's no question that most of you are familiar with the events and people, the chronological order, the development of this fellowship. But the things that I go back to are the spiritual events that took place, a whole series of unrelated events that brought people into being to make it possible for me to stand here tonight and tell you that I am a recovered alcoholic. I didn't say cure now. So some of you purists don't throw a chair. What I'm talking about is I am 12 steps away from my last drink, and I want to talk to you about that as it was implemented at that time. Now, it seems to me that into my consciousness comes an event that I think is so damn important. And I think about this a lot, and I talked about it today with some of our people. We had a beautiful young man in New York by the name of Roland Hazard. He was well-connected socially and politically in every other way, and his family had done a lot for him, and he was an alcoholic, unmanageable, and in the big book we talk about a real alcoholic. This guy was a real alcoholic. He couldn't function. And he had availed himself of every human agency and thing that he could find out to get sober, and he had failed everything. Someone suggested he go to Europe to see the great Dr. Jung, who had an international reputation of being successful in treating mental aberrations and all kinds of problems. And so he went over to Switzerland to see the great doctor, and he went into psychotherapy and treatment, and he was there for a year. And at the end of that time, he had been given all kinds of information about this disease of alcoholism. He was armed with all kinds of information. He was in the pink mentally and physically, and he left there with high hopes that he was now cured. He got back to New York. I don't have to tell you, within a few weeks, he tested this new cure. And oh boy, he was right back where he started, only worse. And I think he proved to us the progressiveness of this awful disease. He was, of course, disappointed. And I guess he was reached that bottom that we talk about. And he went back to see the great doctor. And he said, "Doctor, what the hell are you going to do for me? I have gone through all of the things that you have suggested, and it doesn't work." And the great doctor said this, just think of the integrity of this great scientist. He said, Roland, you are one of those people that have a great need for a path to a higher understanding. You must have a oneness with God. You must equate your oneness with God and the path to a higher power, and you are in need of a religious experience. We can't do anything for you. You are one of those people that have a predisposition for this disease, and we can't help you. So he left there, went back to New York. He fortunately discovered the Oxford Fellowship, from where our whole spiritual concepts come from, word for word. And he was fortunate to get into the group, and I didn't know the man personally, but he did have, I suppose, a spiritual awakening or experience, and he got sober. And in this new dimension, he took it to Abby Thresher, a boyhood chum, who took it to Bill Wilson, who was also a boyhood chum of theirs, and they all went back to the Oxford Fellowship for a number of months and got some more of these goodies, and they got the spiritual concepts. I don't have to tell you too much about this. You know the story. Bill Wilson went out to Akron on, a series of unrelated events, and through the offices of Henrietta Cyberly and Ann Smith, Bob and Bill were put together into an act of love that has been going on ever since. An act of love. Beautiful. It's amazing, in spite of our volatility and all of the things that unlikely that we proceed, for some reason that love has kept been the adhesive forces that kept us together before the traditions, before guidelines, and here we are. So we have that to thank, and I think it was a beautiful, beautiful experience. And so I think for the first time in history, we find these spiritual concepts addressing a problem that has been looked over for thousands of years. Some of my Bible people tell me that the first drunk of record was Noah. Noah got drunk. God called him to task for getting drunk, and Noah said, I didn't know the strength of the grapes. So I think he set up the first denial system we've been using ever since. But looking back at these series of events and these things that I think are so important that are kind of benchmarked in my recovery, I think about the Washingtonians. These people got together, and I understand there was over 100,000+ of these people, alcoholics working with one another, and they found some sobriety. But in their exuberance and so on, they decided to have a conference. They got to watch these conferences. They got out to Boston, and they paraded around the commons and invited people to join their society. Who joined? The do-gooders, the abolitionists, the religious people, and the next thing you know, they fell apart. 6 weeks, they were gone. Think of the thousands and millions of lives that could have been saved if they had spiritual concepts. They didn't have any. Also, the Foxford Fellowship had the spiritual concepts. They were not interested in alcoholism per se, but in mental aberrations and so on, but they had the spiritual concepts. But the ingredient that you and I are concerned with was absent. One drunk sharing with another. Then the full picture, the full circle. Now we had that spiritual experience that Bill and Bob had, sharing one drunk with another. Now we had the spiritual concepts, spiritual experiences of one drunk sharing with another. What a beautiful concept. And off it took. And so for the first time in history, we, the great unwashed, those of us that were relegated to the garbage can, the source of derision, they wiped us off for the first time in history. Release. Release from this awful, awful disease of alcoholism. And as he read this book, this can be permanent. And I want to beat this every time I can to tell you that this is permanent. How do I know? Because there were those who went before me that were like me. Hopeless, chronic alcoholics. That through this facilities that we had were offered these spiritual concepts, not only got sobriety, but found the gift of the second life. And they stayed sober. And there's a lot of them sober today. So the release from alcoholism can be permanent. And I'm not one of those people who want to have a white-knuckle sobriety hanging on and who got out the earliest in the morning and all that kind of crap. Don't tell me that this thing is based on a minute-to-minute. God didn't move. And as long as he's there, he's going to take care of us. He has in the past, he will in the front. I don't know who told me this one time. He said, you know, God didn't save you from the ocean to let you drown in the bathtub. And I kind of like that. I think if I am to share any message, I better share it from my own viewpoint, from my own experience. I don't have any credentials, in spite of my friend telling you that I was a PhD. I am a poor hapless drunk, I guess, but I'm sober tonight. And I think what I'd better do is to share my experience with you in how this recovery system was offered to me and how it was implemented and how I was given the gift of sobriety. Undeserved, perhaps, but I was given the gift of sobriety and also earning the gift of the second life. And so with that in mind, I was raised in a little town over in Missouri. I'm not all bad. I was born in Tennessee. And this was a little German community. These were old world, highly principled, hard bitten. The old world ethics, the work ethics, and it was what you contributed to your family, your community, and country, and God, and that was it. They weren't interested in ostentation. They didn't give a damn what you had. It's what you were and what you did. And I was raised in that atmosphere, and I knew all about these things. It was perfectly satisfactory with me. And I came from an affluent home, and there was a great deal of love in my home. We had one bone of contention, I guess you would call it. My mother was a Southern belle that came out of the deep South from a fundamental religious home. And I don't know, she just had a beautiful, she lived in an unreal world. Everything was beautiful. If the preacher ran away with the organist, he had fallen from grace. It was just that simple. She would not accept the fact that I was an alcoholic. She said I had fallen in with evil companions. So that was it. But my father had an amused contempt for her religious activities. And he always had one eye out for me. And he came to me one day and he said, Paul, watch your mother and your grandmother and your sisters are going to try to get you in that church. And he said, be careful. And he said, I want to tell you what life's all about. He said, church is for the women. They do the praying. They're the givers of life. Help them. We'll provide and protect them. Stay the hell out of their way. Oh, you agree with that, too? It sounded pretty good to me, too. And he said, I want to tell you what life's all about. He said, you become a sportsman, a gentleman, you believe in God, and give the other fellow a break, and that's all there is to it. And that sounded good to me. Three of the four I got, the sportsman, the gentleman, believe in God. But I knew there was a creator, but God, per se, I couldn't handle that. So I moved with what I had. And I think all through my grade school, elementary, prep school, colleges, and so on, I gave every waking moment and I threw myself into an athletic career. I wanted to be a professional athlete. That's all I had in mind. That was my goal. The sports heroes of the days were my gods. Nothing else existed. And if I do say so, the record says I could do it all. I got some national attention, and some of the scouts were looking at me, and I was given all kinds of things. And at the same time, back in those days before radio and television, my God, that's a long time. I was given a car, and I heard someone mention it today. It was a Stutz. To run around town in tooling this car around town, because that's the way things were sold in those days. And I also did some modeling and some photographic work and so on. And so I was kind of building a reputation for myself, and I think I handled it all right. But it gave me a chance to maneuver some people. And so the first thing you know, I maneuvered myself into the school of my choice, the campus, my fraternities, and everything that I wanted to do. So I arrived at this campus in this high-performance car, plus six knickers, a coonskin coat, pork pie hat, and a ukulele. I'm all set to go to work. So I got all of my fraternity brothers and the coaches, and we decided who would do this work for me and who would do that work. Same as I do today, of course. So I launched myself into what laughingly would be called an education. It was my sports athletic career. And I threw myself into this thing with all feet. And I just loved it. And if the world had left me alone, I'd still be doing it, I guess. And I was doing real well. Now, in this fraternity like AA, I had a sponsor, an older classman, and he came to me. And he said, Paul, we've got jocks like you, and we've got scholars, but we all have to be socially adept. And he said, we want to launch you on your social career. You represent the fraternity. We got your date to a prom. You pick up this girl and go to this prom. So I passed the inspection line, got a corsage, picked up this little girl, and went to this prom. Now, at this prom, they were doing a dance called the Charleston. It was kind of like scrimmage in Nebraska, I guess. It was it was really something. But I got in this act, and I'm moving around. The cat said I was cutting a rug or whatever it is. And I'm having a pretty good time. Somewhere during this evening, some skimp introduced me to something called Mastika. Now, of course, this is during Prohibition. Mastika was bathtub gin with some anise in it to cut the berries off the juniper so he could drink it without vomiting. Good stuff, you know, good stuff. So I began to drink this stuff. My head got loose, my feet got loose, and man, I'm doing my thing. And all of a sudden, the dance is over. Everything's shut down. We got in the cars, and we started off somewhere. And the next thing you know, I lost my virginity. So I blew the whole thing that night. My abstinence, my social condition, and my whatever that sexual condition. Now, if you don't think I was an athlete, this was pulled off in the rumble seat of a Ford Roadster. And she was an athlete, too. But the reason I'm telling you about this nonsense is it brought me to a moment of truth. And it was just simply this. The next morning, I got up to the fraternity house, and I had a hangover like, you know, I thought I was dying. I'd never had a hangover. And I went down to breakfast, and all the guys crowded around, patting me on the back. And I was now kind of a half-ass hero. I now had graduated. I was now a man. I'd been drunk, I'd been to a dance, and I'd had some kind of a you-know-what. And so now I was a man. Now, in my day, I was programmed as a straight arrow, and if you did things that were bizarre and out of order, you got chastised. It was none of this. I was patted on the back. And I thought, what the hell's going on here? And I began to take a look at these people, and I thought, I can't put this thing together. Now, unlike most people who talk about their first experiences with drinking, booze didn't do anything for me at all. I never felt the need for euphoria, energy, or to be somebody else. I was always me. I went wherever I wanted, and I didn't pretend. I didn't have to stand back of anybody. I was always out front. But what this booze did to me was put me in contact with some people that I had never known before. These were the fun people. These were the exotic, beautiful people. They were loose with each other. They seemed to be having fun. I had never had any fun. I had been treated like a piece of meat. Go in there and get your head beat off. Come back. How many fingers do I hold? Oh, you still got your head. Go back again. And I took a look at these people who have been hammering me around. I thought, what the hell's going on? Here's the fun people. The hell with them. And so the Keebler syndrome was born. If you don't like it, screw it and walk away. So I decided to do that. But I can tell you that the collision course was there, no question. So pretty soon the newspapers, my family, my coaches, fraternity, everybody fell on me. And I looked at these beautiful, exotic people, and I looked at this mess, and I, no way. So I decided to walk away. Now, in these old German families, you just don't do that, you know. The fast track is fine, but you pick up the bills. They ain't going to subsidize you for being a rummy. So they decided I ought to go to work. So I decided I'd go to work. There was nothing wrong with working. So I went to work for this wonderful, very fine company, and I think through my family's influence that I got in the right way. And in those days, they were picking up tramp athletes to see what they could do with them. And so I got into this company, and within a few short months, they found out that I was not there for a soldier, and I was in there for my business career. But in those days during Prohibition, in order to be acceptable any place, socially or anything, everybody drank. In Prohibition, there were no problem drinkers, alcoholics, social drinkers, everybody drank. So, of course, the thing that all alcoholics have, somehow, I don't know what this is, gravitate towards other alcoholics. And so within the company, I shortly gravitated towards this group, middle management group, and some of the upper management people. And in a few years following, I advanced through this company fairly fast. And also, they found out I could move a golf ball, and so I became part of the entertainment group, and I had thought that was great. You know, I'll get paid for playing golf, getting drunk, and paying for the girls, and I'll tell you, that was a license to steal. I loved that. So this national sales department was great. The only thing was that there was this very subtle personality change. During this time, the next 3 or 4 years, I moved away from all of the things that I held dear, all of the people that I revered. My family, my friends, my schoolmates, everybody were over here. And I was interested only in one thing, and that was business and booze. And I was learning how to drink and drink real hard, as everybody did in those days. And so I moved through this company pretty well. And I was, of course, acceptable to the boozers, and we could do no wrong. The only thing you did was get up and give your company a day's work. If you could do that, you were all right. Many times I just took a shower, put on some clothes, and bragged about what a macho guy I was. As long as you could get up, you were a hell of a man, and that's what I wanted to be, was a hell of a man. Things were going along, I suppose, in a reasonably good way. The war clouds were gathering. The industrial army industry complex was in place. There was chaos and disorder all over the world. And, of course, we were in the war, and I made a pass at the Navy. I thought surely that the Navy couldn't do without me. And I found out that they not only could do without me, but I received a directive to go to Washington in the War Production Authority to represent my company and my industry. And so I went down there and was given a Q clearance, which gave me an opportunity to do almost any damn thing I wanted to and to go any place I wanted to and develop information. Now, you know, telling an alcoholic, you know, no restraints, have fun. That's what it amounted to. So I traveled and I drank and I showed up at the meetings and I guess I did things reasonably well because they didn't run me off, but I certainly could have done a lot better. By that time, I was traveling trains and I never could get off a train. I get on a train and that club card was 2 ounces and I'd start off from Washington to Manhattan and wind up in Boston or Buffalo or some damn place. I could never get off a train. Maybe that's the reason I'm here tonight. I got trainitis or something. But as this went on, I found myself in the unpleasant condition. And when I went to the meetings now, I sat there and I never accepted a cup of coffee or any papers, plans, or specs. I wouldn't touch it because I was shaken. I was shaken and I was hurt and I was scared. And then I developed and found this beautiful India Pale. It was a bitter ale. And I drink 4 or 5 splits of that in the morning to get a shot down in order to eat. And this now was my condition for my social life, my business life, and this was it. And I'll tell you, it was scary. I had a call from my president of my company, my chairman, and he said, I want to meet you over in Manhattan. We have to talk a little bit. And I said, okay. So I got over there and I said, Howard, good to see you. And he was like a wet noodle, and I said, what the hell's the matter? And he said, I want to talk with you. I said, what about? And he said, your name came up, and a lot of the people approved you for a very nice position in our foreign operations. Everybody approved you, and I turned you down. And I said, well, you're a hell of a friend. He said, I'm not your friend. You don't have friends. He said, you have acquaintances. You don't have friends. And he said, you know, you're a moving target. He said, I can never catch up with you. He said, for 3 years, you never tested my judgment, you don't let me know what you're doing, and so on. And he said, we can't have that. He said, you're in a position, he said, we need you and you don't need us. And I said, well, what the hell would you have me do? And he said, you ought to be married. You ought to have a job, a mortgage and some kids, and you ought to need your job. He said, you're a loner. And he said, we can't build on you. And the Keebler syndrome is real simple. I said, well, that's the kind of son of a bitch this company is. You know, I turned around and walked away. Now, to this day, I don't know if the man was going to fire me or help me. I didn't wait. I never waited. And so I was off balance. He'd made a hell of an impression on me. For the first time I was unbalanced, I was shaken. So I went to see my spiritual advisor, a bartender by the name of Sparky. And I said, Sparky, can you imagine that idiot telling me this? And he said, he's right. I said, he's right? He said, yeah. And I said, well, I don't want to get married. Who the hell would marry me? He said, be over tomorrow night. He said, I got a jet setter from Europe. You'll love her. The next night I went over to see her. I don't believe it happened, but it did. And then 1 week later, we were married. Now, this marriage was not made in heaven. She married me to get her second papers to keep from being deported. She was an enemy alien. And I thought maybe I could get a mortgage and some kids and, you know. So this thing went into place. It was very strange, but that nevertheless, I was now married. Then it dawned on me, Jesus, I'm a responsible citizen now. So I got to go to work. I'm not particularly proud of this, but it's a fact. I'm not embellishing it. When I was in Washington, I understood and met a lot of people below the border who were in dire need of refinery equipment, process equipment, power plant, and refinery work. So I went down to Texas, and I made an arrangement with three or four of plants, heavy fabricators, and I began to underwrite some of this tonnage, and in fact, I underwrited some very, very high, heavy tonnages. And within a matter of months, I was making more money in a month than I'd ever made in my life. It just kept coming in. Now, I didn't know anything about money. I'd come out of a manufacturing home. A ton of steel was a ton of steel. A loaf of bread's a loaf of bread. I didn't know anything about money. There it was. So I said, to hell, I might as well spend it. So I went up to Connecticut, and I got a country place. I went down and bought a nice big cruiser and joined all the athletic clubs and country clubs. I remember going into an automobile agency one day, and I bought three luxury automobiles with a personal check. They thought it was with the mafia. I didn't know any better. And off we went. Now, along with this newfound success, in quotations, I found myself beginning to attract some very sleazy people. These were the get-rich-quick guys, the leverage birds. They were going to... how we could get somebody else's equipment and so on for their misfortune. I didn't like them. They reminded me of my fraternity brothers and coaches. So I began to walk away from them. I was getting hard to find. Also, every time I went to Connecticut, the house was full of freeloaders speaking foreign languages, and I didn't like that either. So to make a long story short, in the next few months, I began to walk away, the Keebler syndrome, the hell with it. This marriage turned out to be exactly what it was. It was a political thing. And I'll tell you, I didn't like it. So I began to drink now, not looking for that ale in the morning. But I was drinking the hard stuff, and I was no longer a functional alcoholic, whatever the hell that is. I was now drinking medicinally. If I didn't drink, the withdrawal, sometimes I tried to quit for a couple of days, and it just wasn't worth it. I was beginning to hallucinate at times, and I walked the streets. I did everything. I couldn't seem to handle it. It just was beyond my ken. I got a strange call from one of the agencies, and I went up to Connecticut, and I found out my wife was a spy. That blew my mind, I don't have to tell you. So I got my lawyers together. I said, wipe everybody out and give me a chunk, and I'm gone. And I did what I'm sure all you people have done. I tried the geographical tour. And I left, and I drank at the better clubs and hotels. The descending spiral. Towards the last, I was drinking in places that I got the biggest bang for the cheapest buck. And I was hanging around places, and I felt comfortable in places that I wouldn't have gone in sober for $1 million. In the last 6 months of that activity, I'll tell you, was just hell. I was scared, and I was now being picked up. I'd been once screened. I had been talked to by psychiatrists. I'd been in drunk tanks. And I don't have to tell you what this is like. I was now on the street. It just seemed to me that there was no way, no agency, nothing. And I knew deep down inside of me that there was no way that I could function. And it was getting worse. And as I said, this awful thing that we ultimately developed, this sense of impending doom, I knew that something was going on, the paranoia. I fell into a place that was to be my haven underneath the railroad tracks over in a little town near Cleveland. And especially the house was Purple Death. It was the bottoms out of the wineries. For 14 ounces and 30 cents, you get enough of this crap in you to keep the DTs away. And the bar girls and the prostitutes and the bartenders were my best friends, and they kept me alive. It was in the winter, and I knew that the end was near. And I had a moment of truth. I guess it was a moment of truth when it occurred to me, and I think occur is the only way I can explain this, that I was told, if you stay there, you're going to die, and if you leave, you're going to die. Get the hell out. And I walked up the street. It was below zero, cold. I had no money, no clothes, nothing. I don't know where mentally I couldn't function. There was no logic to anything I was doing, but up the street I went. And as I put one foot in front of the other, and I was told that this was an out-of-body experience, I don't know what it was, but it seemed to me that I could see myself. I heard bells and whispers and songs, and people were talking. Sometimes they were hostile, sometimes they were friendly. And it doesn't seem to be any threat. I just kept moving along, one foot in front of the other. And I remember this, and I think the clarity of it, I could almost bring it back moment by moment if I would be regressed. But nevertheless, I kept going up that street, and believe it or not, I walked into a hotel, a modest hotel. The assistant manager saw me and put me in a room. I understand I hadn't been out of my linens. I didn't know if I'd been to the bathroom or not. You know, I don't have to tell you what people like me look like. Now, here is the series of unrelated events. When I look back, I see the hand of God in this thing from the very beginning. A, B, C. This youngster was an in-law of one of the boys from Akron. They had been up in Detroit and had stopped there to visit and were on their way back to Akron. And he called him and he said, I got a rummy over in the hotel I want you to talk to. He said, we don't do that. He said, you go see this guy. He's in trouble. So he persuaded him to come to see me. Now, I want to share with you this experience because when I look back, it's a benchmark in my recovery. And it's an experience that I wouldn't want to go through again for $1 million, but I would give $1 million if I had. It was that vital. So I don't know whether it was a matter of minutes or half an hour or a few hours. A knock came on the door and the boys came in. And they looked me over and they said, we understand you're in trouble. I said, trouble? What the hell are you talking about? And they said, look, we got some good news for you. Now, I could almost recall this 12-step meeting, word for word, but to paraphrase it, it went something like this. They said, you know, we'd like to tell you about our drinking experiences. Now, understand, I had defended my right to drink, and under the duress and all kinds of coercion, I had never admitted to ever having drunk more than 2 beers. And here were these guys talking about drinking on a level that I understood without any embarrassment at all. They were sharing with me their drinking experiences, and their honesty was completely disarming. I opened my heart and mind the same as they did to me, and we were sharing our drinking experiences like we'd known each other for 100 years. And I knew these guys were pros, and there was no embarrassment, and they were not talking to me from a righteous position. And they didn't moralize, and they didn't talk down to me at all. For the first time in my life, people were talking with me. And as we talked, in crept a word every now and then called alcoholism and AA. And finally, it got down to this AA and alcoholism, and they mentioned something about it. And I said, hell, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm a drunk and I'm nuts. And they said, that's right. That's what you are. Well, we think you're an alcoholic. And I said, what the hell's the difference between a drunk and an alcoholic? And I want to repeat this because I think this is the moment of truth for me. And they said, you are one of these people. We don't know whether you have a predisposition for it or susceptibility for it genetically. We don't know anything about it and care less. But there are people like you that have a drinking experience that sometime in life do irreparable damage to themselves physically. It will never be repaired. It'll be with you the rest of your life. It is progressive. You'll never be able to drink successfully. You are an alcoholic. And I said, well, what the hell chance have I got? And they said, none. And I said, well, what do we do? And they said, this physical addiction is the answer to your recovery. The root cause of that physical addiction is a compulsion. It takes over your sanity. You can't exercise your will, and your life is unmanageable. And I said, for God's sakes, that's what it is. And so the whole thing came together. They said, as an alcoholic, the things you've done and have not done that you should have done, you are guiltless of it, but you are responsible. And so the guilt flew out the window. And they said, we want to ask you a question. Did you go to your high school counselor and tell him you wanted to be a drunk? I said, no. They said, did you marry a woman in your country and embarrass your family and so on? I said, no. They said, why did you do it? I said, I don't know. They said, that's right. You don't know. But if you come with us and do what we tell you, you can be like us. You'll never have to drink again. You'll be reasonably happy. And we can promise you a life of sobriety and living in a dimension you never dreamed of. And I said, for someone like me? And they said, yes. Now understand, they said, we want a commitment. There was none of this desire crap that you hear today. We want to commit when you do what we're told. Now maybe you didn't have to surrender, but I did. I didn't want to die. I didn't have any options. Some of you people have options. I didn't. And so I went with the boys, and they said, it's real simple. We have a system. We don't hear too much about this today, I don't think, but I believe in its integrity and its efficacy. And it's called HALT, hunger, anger, lonely, tired. Don't be too hungry, lonely, and tired. 60% of our relapses is because we can't manage our affairs to keep in tune with that four absolute, or those HALT. And so I went down with them, and they filled me full of some rye whiskey, and I got a little peraldehyde and some tomato juice and sauerkraut juice, and they said, don't cough. So I got it on all right. Now, when they said something about being lonely, I was never alone. They picked me up, and I ate in their homes. They took me to their offices. They took me to their social events. I was there all the time, and what was going on was this. I saw families that had been split apart being put back together. I got intimately acquainted with people who had been like me that were now living successfully, and I wondered what the hell this was all about. And as I became more and more acquainted, and as I saw them not only talking the talk, but living and walking the walk and living this way, they were not only sober, but happy and full of goodwill. I had never seen people like this. Never. And so I made a few inquiries. And they said, we live a God-directed life. A God-directed life. Boy, I'll never be able to make this thing. But nevertheless, I hung around. Now, at the end of 4 months, I was sober, a white-knuckle sobriety. The sobriety of the time and kind that I was wound up so tight I couldn't buy a wrist. I couldn't even buy a newspaper without a fist fight. It was just unbelievable. They would talk to me about things, and I'd forget them. My memory retention was about that long. But I was trying. And I went down to the meeting that night, and I heard a talk. Our meetings were entirely different then than they are now. And I heard the talk that night, and I realized how helpless and how far out I was. I was discouraged and despondent. I wanted to be like them, but I knew I didn't have the wheels. So I went over to see Paul Stanley, who was to be my sponsor. He was one of the early people then. And Paul had a great deal of information out of the Oxford Fellow. He was a beautiful man. And I went to see him, and I said, Paul, I ain't going to make this thing. And he said, why not? And I said, well, you and Bob Smith and Dotson and all the people talk about the Sermon on the Mount and King James Bible and William James' experience in philosophy. And I said, I can't find my ass with both hands in back of me. I have no way. I'm just a tramp athlete. I don't have any classical information. I don't have any religious or philosophical convictions. I just don't have anything going for me. He said, that's good. I said, what? He said, that's good. And I said, Paul, why would you say that? He said, you don't have to unlearn anything. Now, I thought about this 1,000 times, and I'm going to share it with you. It may go over like a lead balloon. I don't know. But it seems to me the people that come to us who feel that they're special and have credentials, that want to bring into our fellowship their uniqueness and their super imposing, leave it at the door. We don't need it in here. We don't need it. And so we talked about this, and he said, if you want to, he said, I will sponsor you. And he said, if I sponsor you, I want you to do one thing. Do not talk to anybody else. Don't read any books. We don't deal in problems, we deal in solutions. And if you want to get well, I will be your sponsor, and I will tell you this, we have no experts. Bob Smith is not an expert, I'm not an expert, and believe it or not, we don't have any experts in New York, contrary to what you may hear. But he said, what we do is accept the steps as the authority. And if you will follow the steps, and I will share with you my experience and understanding of the steps, you too can get well. And I said, fine, Paul. And he said, I'm going to take you on a series of spiritual experiences. This series of spiritual experiences begins with the third step, and it is a momentum, and it overlaps, and it takes you through to the ninth. And when you have completed those steps, you will have had some emotional stability. You'll recover physically and mentally, and you'll be able to function, and you will have been rid of that awful iron grip of the compulsion will be gone. And he said, you'll be well on your way to a new life. And I said, Paul, people like me can do this. He said, yes. I said, my God, let's do it. So he said, well, we'll begin with the third step. I said, no problem, I read it. He said, what? I said, I read it. 3 hours later, I understood what the step was about. And he said, tonight we take the third step, and you take it in front of the group on your knees. And I said, oh boy. So I went down, and I knelt in front of the group, and I said the third step prayer. That I turn my will and my life over to the care of God, that He remove the bondage of self, that I may be an instrument and function in behalf of our Father in service. Now, a strange thing happened. When I got through with that offering, when I got up, I had a feeling as though the fellowship and the group had accepted me. There had been a move away from complete isolation into the group. I was now one of. Nobody had laughed at me. I don't think it was a spiritual experience or whatever it was, but it was a movement away from self. And I was part of the group, and I felt it, and the group accepted me that way. One of. What a beautiful feeling. No longer isolated. Beautiful. And I said to Paul, what do I do? And I said, we take an inventory. And we didn't do it like you do it in a big book. He said, I want to make a list of your antecedents, your family, your social life, your business affairs, your citizenship, human ecology, and the mankind in general. And you put down everything you're ashamed of you did you wish you hadn't done. You put down the things that you should have done that you didn't do, omissions and commissions. And if it's on your conscience, put it down. And I did this. And when I looked at it, I was appalled. Ooh. I thought, what the hell is this? And he said, I want you to take a good look because that's who you are. Not who you think you are, not your background, your education, or anything else. You are who you are. You are the sum total of your experiences. That's who you are. I said, my God, Paul, what do we do? He said, we take every one of your wrongs and we put a criteria to it that you can understand. I said, what's that? He said, we have four absolutes, honesty, unselfishness, purity, and love. And he said, you take every one of those wrongs and you can establish the nature of the wrong. The nature of the wrong. A lie is a lie is a lie. Selfishness is selfishness is selfishness. There's no mystery about that. You don't have to get any ABC or 12 and 12 or books or anything. A lie is a lie is a lie. Anything contrary to those four absolutes was real simple. And as a result of that, I got rid of the chaff down to the flagrant things that were holding him in. And I said, Paul, what am I doing with this? And he said, you find someone and you take these wrongs and you surrender them. You surrender them to another human being and God. And I said, well, what's going to happen? He said, go do it. I went out to St. Louis and I found a kid that had caddied for me. We'd been raised together. And I said, Rowdy, I need about 10 minutes of your time. 4 hours later, I'm pummeling this guy with this stuff. His eyes are getting bigger. I want to tell you how dishonest I was. Do you know, after going through all that excruciating, painful analysis and all of that stuff, I had two things I wasn't going to tell him. And I think when I began to relate this, I found out the difference between confession and catharsis. Before I was through, out popped the two things. God didn't want me to be a liar. And so I got it. I went back to see Paul, and I said, Paul, I've had a religious experience. He said, you're only beginning. I said, what the hell now? He said, look down here, sixth and seventh step, those cancerous, awful things that are eating you up, that must be dealt with, not from your resources or not from your values, but from God's. And he said, you're Jack going on your knees again before the group. And this time, he said, I want you to consider the God of love. Strongly consider that you consider a God of love. He said, after all, you came here, you got sober. Where the hell do you think you got it? And I said, I don't know. He said, it was a gift of God. He said, now you've got to earn his grace. And he said, the seventh step and the eighth, or the sixth and seventh step, you sit down. And he said, this time, surrender it all. Surrender the good and the bad. And I said, okay. So I went down, I went through the seventh step prayer again, that I surrendered it all, the good and bad, that I make you his will. Now, what was going on was an amazing thing. And I said, Paul, if I do this, these shortcomings and defects, is God going to remove these things? He said, yeah. I said, when? And he said, when he removes them will be the result of you immediately making a list of people you've harmed and make restitution and amends. Without making restitution and amends, there is no regeneration. There is no spiritual awakening. He said, you have to remove every obstacle that you can between God and your fellow man if you're going to be in harmony with God and his will. Even I could understand that. And man, removing the obstacles between God and your fellow man. And I said, Paul, will this thing really go? So I did. Now it says in the big book, and you've all read it, if you have been painstaking about this phase of the program, you can expect these promises to happen. Believe me, the promises did happen. In the meantime, I'd met this lovely girl. I'd met her in AA. She had been a chanteuse. She'd had a little band. You go around these supper clubs, Mullen and Bill Bailey come home, you know, all that crap. And I was in a joint one night, and she was moaning and groaning, and I was making faces and holding my nose, and they threw me out. And I walk into a meeting, and there she is. She didn't say anything, and we didn't even talk about it. She was one of the first two girls in the Cleveland Akron area, and they didn't like girls. And this other girl came in, Kitty Cobain. Between the two of them, they were allowed to sit in the meetings and occasionally make their presence known, but just enough to keep them tuned. But she was smart. She knew how to handle people. So things went along real well. And we were the two youngsters. And whenever there was any activity, somebody would take Paul, take Kay, Kay, take Paul. And I got acquainted with this gal. And gosh, I got so I liked her. And pretty soon, I began to look for her. I felt happy when I was around her. And I don't know. I didn't know how to handle this. I had never had a platonic relationship with a woman. I didn't know anything about women. I sure and hell knew nothing about love. I guess I did. I thought love was a 400 horsepower blonde, a case of scotch, and a rainy week. If I knew their last name, it was true love. I They all had the first names were the same. It was Baby. But anyhow, I got acquainted with this gal, and the more I saw her, and the more I liked her, and she also reinforced some of the spiritual principles we were talking about. And I felt that she was kind of a natural thing, and we fell together. And after a while, I decided I'd have to go back to work. And I said, I don't want to leave this lovely girl. And we talked it over and decided to get married. In those days, you got married, you know. So we got married, had a lovely home full of love, some nice kids. And had she lived to this month, between the two of us, we'd have had 93 years of sobriety. Now, this is a part of the program that I would like to offer merely as a message. At the end of 5 years, my life was back together again. I was back with my industry, with my company. I had recouped whatever the hell I thought I'd lost and more. I was now a member of my industry. I was back, and I had made restitution and amends, and it's a beautiful thing when you make amends and restitution to people. It's amazing what happens when you take these absolutes into your life. I remember one time in my amendment program, up came a guy down in Cincinnati, and he was kind of the leader of our industry. I didn't like this guy. I hated his guts. He was a pompous bastard. My sponsor said, go to Cincinnati and make a restitution to me. I said, I wouldn't go down there for $1 million. He said, you want to be drunk? I said, I'll go. I went down to see this guy. He ran a big company, and I went into his office. Instead of asking me to sit down, he took me to the director's room. He sat at one end, and I'm at the other. What can I do for you? He said. And I said, Dave, I've always hated your guts. I don't like you. I probably never will. But I said, I've done a lot of things that I'm ashamed of. I've lied about you. I've slandered it. I've broken the market. I've done all the things I shouldn't have done, and I'm ashamed of it. I may not be able to make restitution and amends, but from this moment on, you may rest assured that anything I tell you will be right, and I will try to be a positive influence for the industry. And his eyes got about that big, and he said, what the hell is this all about? So I told him about the group over in Akron and so on, and he said, Paul, I was always afraid of you. And I said, how come? He said, you got drunk over in Pittsburgh and going to piss me out of a 9-story window in a hotel. So sometimes there's two sides to the story. But the reason I'm telling you this is because he was so amazed in my attitude and the things I was dealing with and in truth and in love. He called in his union people, he called in his personnel people and his sales people, and I stayed there all afternoon. And he put in what we call today an EAP program. And as God is my judge, in the next 40 years, I'll bet 10,000 people got sober in Texas, and or Kentucky, and Ohio, and down in that area. Now, the reason I'm mentioning that is that never sell short or try to evaluate your efforts from your own viewpoint. Bill and Bob together put into an act of love the things that we're hearing. The same thing is true of each one of you. Whenever you act in favor of someone else and act in love and truth, it'll never be destroyed. Never be destroyed. Just think, if I had passed up the opportunity to make restitution and amends, a lot of people's lives could have been lost. And the same thing is true with you. Out there are people that you're going to meet you don't know, that you have and are crooked. Unlike a lot of people, you can save lives. The preachers can't do it. The doctors can't do it, but you can do it. Because you are endowed and you have this facility for doing this. You carry with it truth and love. Oh boy, what potent force it is. So all I can say is that at the end of that time, I was living in a dimension I'd never lived in before. And then the shortcomings and the defects. I hate to tell you about this, but truth demands it. I became so far removed from manageability that I didn't even know where my priorities were. I sometimes Work 4 or 5 days without any sleep, get Keebler to do it. I was trying to do everything, as one of the men said here tonight. He was the guardian of all of the things that were good. I tried to handle everybody's affairs of my own. I wasn't handling anything. And I was getting up in the morning, and I was late for work, and I drove my car like a nut, and when I looked at the daily activities, I was finding hostility and antagonism. People were calling me for 12-step work, and I was too busy. They said, "We'd like to have you come and talk." And I said, "Don't you think you ought to get somebody else? I spoke over there 2 years ago." And I said to myself, I had paid my dues. I'm going to sit in the back and give it to the new people. Now, you were told tonight you're the most important people in the room. You are the pig's eye. I am. And as long as I can carry and share a message, I'm going to be important to you, to God, my fellow man, and to myself. And as I began to look at the day, and I found that I was not being very happy, and I was trying to deal with shortcomings and defects from my own viewpoint. I heard a guy tell me one time, "Hell, you can buy a book on how to make $1 million, how to influence people, how to make love standing up in a hammock if you want." But this is not the thing that you do. We have to deal from these spiritual values, and the values have to be earned one moment at a time, one day at a time. And each spiritual experience becomes a value. And pretty soon, we move away from that self-centeredness. And all of a sudden, the self-centeredness goes down and the self-esteem goes up. It was happening to me, but it was in the reverse. And I went home one night and I said, "Kay, there's something I held wrong." She said, "I think I know what it is." I said, "What's that?" She said, "Well, you have to get back in the way." I said, "My God, don't tell me that. I've run all over the damn country. I've answered telephone calls. I've done all." She said, "I'm not talking about activity. I'm talking about the plan for daily living. The 10th, the 11th, and the 12th step. 10th, the 11th, and the 12th. I had forgotten that personal recovery does not guarantee me a path to a higher understanding. I was not improving my conscious contact with God. I was taking care of Paul Keebler's affairs, and I wasn't practicing these concepts into my other affairs. And she said, "Let's take our inventories tonight." We took them together. And when I looked at the day, not so much for the things that I did, that wasn't killing me. It was the things that I wasn't doing that I should have been doing. I could have been a lot more tolerant. I could have been kinder. I could have been more concerned. I could have gotten up early enough to say my prayers and meditation. And I could have answered the phone without slamming it down. And when I went out in the plant, people wouldn't scatter. They'd come to me because I would help. That personality defects were coming in. They were flooding in. And so we began to take that inventory at night, and I got back to prayer and meditation. And when I took the daily inventory, it just seems as though the 10th, the 11th, and the 12th are interlocked and intertwined in such a way that you can't take the inventory without praying and meditating. She said, "It's real simple. When we get into the meditation, we surrender these shortcomings and defects to God, that He takes it all, that He removes from us the things that are keeping us in a state of apathy, complacency." God, I've seen it happen so often. The 5, 6, 10-year people, I heard Dick say today that sometimes it gets a little stale. Sometimes it's hard for us to sit and listen to other people. But it isn't if we say those prayers in meditation. Because when we go in, we ask God to remove those things that are keeping us from the apathy and complacency. Because this is what is going to kill my butt. Now, I'm not one of these people that pray and go walk in traffic. You get your ass run over. All I'm going to tell you is this. That I have been through situations which meant that I could not deal with life from my own resources. And why? Because I only have half the story. Do you ever see the guy or woman that comes to the meeting wants to share a problem? He only got half the problem, and he wants you to hear the rest so you'll agree with half the problem. That's how I was trying to run my life. I didn't have the facts. I didn't understand the spiritual concepts
These spiritual concepts are structured in such a way that all we have to do is examine, is it true, is it false, how does it affect the other fellow, is it ugly or beautiful? Beauty, true love, God's love, the kind of love unqualified. What are we trying to do? We're trying to find out something about God's love. He loves us for what we are, what he is, not what we are, and thank God for that. So as the more I got into this act in the prayer and meditation, the more I moved away from that complacency, the apathy, in dealing with life from my own viewpoint. It was easier to trust God. Why not? He was constant, unchanging, unqualified, always there. The only time that anything moves was me. He never moved. I moved. And so if I was to get back in harmony with his will, I have to keep my conscience clean, and I have to practice to the best of my ability to keep it clean, but to go on to a path to a higher understanding. And I think that Dr. Young was the people I just believed that God kept put in our way that brought us this message. And he said, you are in need of a pathway to a higher understanding. Think of that. The first time in history, perhaps. This is later Bill, Bob, and the rest of the fellowship and the people. And the amazing part about it, that Bill and Abby and the boys were going to the Oxford Fellowship in New York, and Bob and the Stanley boys were all going to Akron. So we had the spiritual concepts. Nobody's going to defeat love. Nobody's going to say love doesn't belong in this fellowship. And other people say, no, absolute. There's an absolute. You better not drink. And also we talk about rigorous honesty. We talk about all kinds of things dealing with this pathway to a higher understanding. And so it seems to me that when I began to implement these absolutes, that things fell into place. I'm going to be very candid and talk to you about a very personal thing tonight. And I hope you accept this in the spirit I said. I was at the hospital. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning. And I was in the lounge, the waiting room there. And a doctor came by and he said, what are you doing here by yourself? And I said, what do you mean by myself? He said, well, where's your family? Where's it? I said, well, I don't know. I hadn't thought much about talking to them. And he said, well, he said, Jesus, he said, it's pretty lonesome here. And all of a sudden I said, now's the time. So I went down in the chapel. And I walked in this beautiful little chapel, and it had a leaded windows. It's a beautiful little thing. And thousands of times I've went to my knees, and I've prayed and meditated. And I pulled a prayer bench out, and I knelt, and I looked up at that beautiful window, and I began to pray and meditate. No way. There was a block of some kind I couldn't think. The apprehension and fear and concern for my wife and the family and the future was just, it was so bleak I couldn't handle it. Just absolutely a void. And I thought, after all these years that I've sat up in front of people and talked about prayer and meditation, and here I am by myself and I haven't got anything going for me. What the hell can I do? And I just suddenly knelt there, and all I'm going to tell you is I'm going to call this thing an occurrence. It occurred to me to be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am God. And I got up from there. I went to the elevator and I went back upstairs. I felt and knew that whatever was to happen would be the right thing, to be still and know that I am God. And when I look back at that, it seemed to me that this beautiful pathway to a higher understanding, that I was truly in contact, that the God of love had reached out to me, had taken my wife, and he took us all home. And I feel that that's what happened. And it was a beautiful experience. None of us are prepared for the loss that we have. I was angry. I was hurt, and I was scared. My guts were bleeding, and I wished to hell he had left me alone. But that's part of the price we pay for love. And he loved her, and he loved me, and he loves us all. I'm going to say one more thing, if you'll indulge me. I'm kind of dumping on you tonight, but thank you. I think the other benchmark in my recovery was in Akron. Bob Smith was dying, and he sent word to us that he wanted to talk to us. He had a message. And we went over to the public square building, and I think there was 500 or 600 maybe. And he wheeled in a chair, and Bill and some of the VIPs from New York were there and so on. But Bob got up to talk, and he couldn't make it and sat down and apologized. And his opening remark was how grateful he was that he had an opportunity to see us and to know that he had had a small part in our recovery. Think of that, a small part. And he said, I have a message. And he said, the message is, keep the program simple. Beware the Freudian complexes that are of interest only to the scientific mind. Watch that errant member of the tongue that has caused us so much trouble in the past. If we use it, let us use it with forbearance and tolerance. Always remembering that we needed a pat on the back as new people that did. And all of our steps and traditions simmer down. Come up with two ideas, love and service. Love and service. And that is the basis for our recovery. I think I had been searching all of the time for a guideline. And here it was, love and service. And I left that meeting that day, and I will tell you standing here that I have never looked back. I have never wondered what kind of an alcoholic I was, or if I hadn't been, what I would have been. I have never once ever questioned the fact that I, maybe if I'd have done things differently, I wouldn't have been an alcoholic. I have never once worried about relapses, yours or mine. I have completely put my trust into these spiritual concepts as a structure for this higher plane, and I have always kept in contact with those who went before me. They're getting thinner and thinner. But they proved that the release from alcoholism can be permanent. And that's what I'm interested in, can be permanent. And so with that in mind, I left there. And I think that to this day, I've found nothing yet that is a substitute for or a better idea or promises an easier, shorter, softer way than those 6 or 12 steps and those 4 absolutes and relating to God and this beautiful fellowship. I'd like to close, if you'll indulge me, by reciting the Serenity Prayer. And I think one of the things, I think we've sort of shortchanged ourselves, and I think that it's kind of a sad thing that we don't use a Serenity Prayer in its entirety. I think it's the epitome of our fellowship. I think it's the epitome of our recovery system, talking about God, ourselves, relating to our recovery. Of course, it goes like this. God grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things that we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Living one moment at a time, enjoying one day at a time, accepting hardship as a pathway to peace, trusting he will take this world as it is, not as I would have it. And if I surrender to his will, he will make all things right, that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with him forever in the next. Thank you.